more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. It's the 10th of December, and astute holiday shoppers will note that we're 15 days away from Christmas, but only 6 days away from the first night of Hanukkah. If you have book lovers on your list, and many of us do, it's easy to find yourself aimlessly wandering the aisles of a bookstore, although that's not such a bad thing, but not if you're looking for inspiration.
So in the spirit of a more efficient trip to the bookstore, Daniel Golden, proprietor of Boswell Book Company, joins us with his suggestions for some of the most interesting and distinctive gift books on the shelves this season. Thank you for stopping by.
It is always a pleasure.
What is your working definition of gift books?
Well, obviously, we are big fans of all books being gift
right,
books.
Right, exactly.
But I was specifically looking at a few different things. First of all, I wanted books that were not one narrative. I wanted them to be able to be broken up and they could be read in order, but more likely they would be browsed. I really thought there needed to be an illustration component to it, and whether that was photographs or maps or graphs or all of the above. And I also thought that there had to be something interesting physically about the book.
And not that you wouldn't necessarily buy these any time of the year, but this might be the ideal time of the year to walk into a bookstore and see something like this and say, hey, this reminds me of Cousin Sally.
Exactly. One of the reasons why that happens is many of these books are odd shapes and sizes, and they don't fit very well on shelves or they get lost on the shelves. And really, honestly, the holidays are the only time that a store can keep their stock high enough that we can have multiples of these books. And so what happens during some other times of the year is you have one copy of the book, it gets a little shop-worn, they don't want it. This time you have a pile of five, they take the second one down if they're that kind of person. And they're happy. So and plus they see them. You know, we do have displays all different kinds of the times of the year, but this does seem to be when a lot of these books come out too.
Well, let's talk about some of the eye-catching books that are out there. And let's start with one that is getting a lot of attention from history buffs, and that's World War I in 100 Objects. And this is, if not part of a series, certainly part of a genre that has come down the pike in recent years.
It is absolutely part of a genre. I call it the history of this and that. And it's been going on for probably 5 to 10 years. Origins are in Great Britain. Ironically, even some of the ones that are about American objects, whether they be just general objects or maps. I've seen comics. I've seen histories in terms of books. Stamps has been very popular. They generally come from the United Kingdom. This new one is World War I in 100 Objects. And what's interesting about that is it's the intersection of two big trends because it is, of course, the 100th anniversary of World War I. And there have been World War I books coming out all year. This is everything from medals to prison paraphernalia to weapons to iconic booklets, and representative of all the different countries that were fighting the battles.
I think on the inside cover, or maybe it's the title page, it's barbed wire.
Right, which is
you think of on a farm these days, but had its origins in the trenches in World War I.
It's written by Peter Doyle. It came out, interestingly enough, in Great Britain from a publisher called History Press, which is known here for their Milwaukee. They do regional books, and we actually carry a lot of History Press titles, but nothing quite so beautiful as this.
So that's the history of World War I in 100 Objects. Now, there is a really beautiful book in front of you. It is called Animalium. And it does not have authors listed. Rather, it has curators listed. What's that all about?
Yes, it's also a British publication, and they do see it as almost like a museum in a book. It's like having the Milwaukee Public Museum in a book. Katie Scott is the illustrator. Jenny Broom is the writer. And it is a beautiful, oversized book. It's another kind of book that during the rest of the year might get damaged. It's 11 by 15, which is a big book.
But you wouldn't want a book smaller than this considering the illustrations.
Well, no. So every spread, it starts with the invertebrates, goes up to the mammals, and it looks at all sorts of classes of, from marsupials to various kinds of birds. And the thing that's beautiful about this book, it's all about Katie Scott's illustrations. They are magnificent. They're old-fashioned but very modern. She has a beautiful sense of color. Even when some, like the rodents, are all sort of brown, everyone looks like a painting that you would want in your house. And I love the way that even though they're all still illustrations,
It looks like they're about to come off the page.
Right. And the animals sort of – she designed them so that the tails sort of find the white space and the – the heads are poked. I mean, you can tell that she has, you know, just has a beautiful sense of color and style and image and movement. Yes, it does feel like they're all jumping off the page. And there's lots of great little details. It was meant to be for kids, but I see a ton of adults wanting this book.
So that's Animalium, curated by Katie Scott and Jenny Broom. Let's talk about some maps now. You have in front of you a fairly large, substantial volume called Great Maps, the World's Masterpieces Explored and Explained.
One of the things that's ironic is as people lose their everyday use of things. So, for example, we don't have as many folded paper maps as we did. They become very interested in the right collection of that. And map books continue to be very popular. This is actually put together by a man named Jerry Broughton, though you wouldn't see his name on the front cover. It's actually a Smithsonian book, which is a little odd only because it's a London professor who put it together, but irrelevant because it's maps from the whole world. The United States, Great Britain, China, it is particularly strong on historical maps. These are some of the greatest maps in history, the Madaba Mosaic Map. And
and who doesn't know about the Madaba Mosaic Map?
No, Juan de la Costa's world chart. And so they take the big map and then they break it down into little components. It's heavily annotated. So there's lots of beautiful pictures, but there's lots of wonderful text in it too. If you've ever seen it's from DK, and if you've ever seen a DK travel guide, it's sort of like a historical DK travel guide.
So that is Great Maps. And speaking of annotations, another very large book in front of you is the new annotated H.P. Lovecraft. And for folks who don't know H.P. Lovecraft's name, what's the significance of Lovecraft's work?
Lovecraft is considered the first modern horror writer. Actually, in his day when he was alive, he wrote for pulp magazines and he was pretty much unknown. And now folks like Alan Moore, the great graphic novel person, and Neil Gaiman are huge fans. He changed horror because it used to be gothic. And he sort of moved it in the direction of Aliens Among Us. And the book is great. It's beautiful. And the way I've read a lot of these annotated books, they tend to be things like Pride and Prejudice and Wizard of Oz. You get the text of the book in the middle and all the fascinating annotations on the side, including photographs and maps that seem to be in all these things.
This is really for someone who likes to watch the DVD and then play the alternate track of the director and the star kind of commenting on it as it goes.
These are, in fact, director's cuts. But we're excited about this. And one of the things to note is that while horror tends to be a very popular genre, it's phenomenally popular in film, and it's obviously with American Horror Story. There's definitely more horror on television too. In the book world, it's sort of a little stagnant. But one of the reasons we don't realize how popular it is we call a lot of horror dark fantasy. It's actually been renamed sort of like the way, you know, the toilet becomes the water closet, that kind of thing.
I'm sure H.P. Lovecraft would appreciate the analogy. Let's go to something completely different here, and that is the best American infographics. Infographics have come a long way, and they are all over us. So this is really kind of culling the herd for us.
They are definitely trending up. One of the reasons is because computers really help create them. They're many of them are so intricate that for somebody to draw these, it might take them 6 months. And especially for a throwaway formerly in a newspaper and now for us to like on Facebook, you know, you just wouldn't have these people doing it. This book is fascinating. It is the newest extension of the Best American series. We still sell, as do any bookstore or website, Best American Short Stories, Mysteries, Essays. There's other people doing poetry, plays, math problems.
I don't know that I could imagine a best American math problem, but one of the things that really struck me about the infographics is it really runs the gamut of topics from, you know, politics to science to just about anything you can imagine, to sports.
Absolutely. There's the analysis of different kinds of fastballs. There's the top trends in cosmetic procedures. There's an intricate infographic about how to pick a pope with a map, an annotated sort of map, diagram, graph component to it. This has proven to be a very popular collection because one of the things is you see these things on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram and they're lost and you have a physical, very nice, very reasonably priced package of really cool Info.
So that's Best American Infographics 2014. Let's go back to travel for just a moment, and maybe travel for kids. There is a collection of, I think it's 17 kids' books that you might remember from when you were a kid. It's called This Is the World.
Oh, I hope you remember it. If not, you didn't have as good a childhood as we did.
Or you're young.
That's right. I suppose so. Though they have been reissuing some of them. They obviously have to update them and edit them a little. So this is the author-illustrator is Miroslav Zizek. When I was a child and I'd go to the library and take out This Is London, This Is New York, This Is Paris, This Is Rome, This Is Munich, we didn't travel much. We went to like – we went 100 miles away to
– This is Tarrytown.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. New York joke there. So this was my way of seeing the world. And I love this book. It is beautifully reproduced. It's very historical because obviously the contemporary stuff is dated. These books came out in this volume from 1959 to 1974 with a very strong focus on the early 1960s. But the illustrations are just beautiful. He has a very wonderful sense of color, and there's almost a collage element. I don't think they're cut paper, but you can see the way he uses white space and the way he uses unusual texturing that just pops the illustrations off the page. So for adults, there's just a very strong sense of memory that comes from this.
And it is a rather expensive book, but it is actually 17 books, as you point out.
It's 17 books for $35. That's $2 a book. Really, can you beat that?
That's This Is the World. Let's talk about a couple of regionally significant books, one by a regional author and one with a regional subject. We'll start with At Home with Jane Austen.
That's right. Kim Wilson is a Waukesha writer. What this is a collection of travels that Austen made to Bath, her trips to London, and especially the Jane Austen house. And it's stories, descriptions of what she might have been doing, illustrations from the time, contemporary photos, documents. Austen, you know, there's no classic writer bigger, though my middle sister will tell you that when she was in grad school 40 years ago, nobody was reading her. So so one day, we may be all looking at Lovecraft and saying, Austen who?
So that's At Home with Jane Austen by Kim Wilson. There's also a book with locally relevant subject matter, and that is a kind of really interesting book of historical photographs and narrative called Pabst Farms.
The History of a Model Farm. John Eastberg is the historian for the Pabst Mansion, and he wrote a beautiful book on the Pabst Mansion as well as Leighton's Legacy last year he co-wrote. This is about the farms because apparently – the Pabst didn't only love beer. They also loved horses. And once you get through this book, they were pretty fond of cheese too. So this is about the Pabst Farm. We know the Pabst Farms in Oconomowoc. They're being redeveloped into multi-use. But this is also about their farms in Wauwatosa, actually. So they did a beautiful job, wonderful local history, delicious Pabst et cheese spread.
Right. One of the things as we were flipping through this book that struck me is how it kind of expands what our understanding of what the Pabst family was into. It is really not just about one particular line of beer. They were into a lot of things. There was malt syrup. There was the ginger ale as well, which I guess was made in Sheboygan. You know, it's a good chance to see what parts of the Milwaukee area were like 100 years ago.
Absolutely. It's a great for anybody who loves Milwaukeeana, Wisconsinalia. And it's, you know, and they did have quite the model dairy.
Two more books to mention. One we briefly mentioned on a previous conversation, but the book wasn't out yet, and now it is. And it is every bit as cool as you made it seem. It's called Before and After.
It is a French package, and fortunately, it has no words, so it didn't really need much translation. And it is a beautiful book, very inexpensive. It was published by a children's publisher. So they said it's good for ages 4 to 8 because they saw it as a hardcover picture book. That is ridiculous. One of my booksellers said, this should say 4 to 80. And I said, no, 800. People who are cryogenically frozen should also have the option of looking at this book when they come out. It is 2- and 4-page spreads, beautiful illustrations, beautiful conceptualization of every different kind of before and after. The wheat that becomes the bread, the coffee beans that become the coffee, the frog looking at the fly that eats the fly. What I love about this, it's sad, it's happy, it's funny. And there's a great sense of cohesion. So like the same window image shows up later. It's got a really great sense of humor. I have customers who have been buying it, and then they come back and buy three more. Definitely great for kids, wonderful for classroom, for playing with a very young kid and showing them the pictures. They'll love it, but adults will love it too.
It's a conversation starter.
Absolutely.
And finally, a book that you tell me you are reading line by line, and it's 500 pages long, which is saying something. What is American Cornball?
American Cornball is a laugh-a-pedic guide to the formerly funny.
Which I think people are going to use to describe this interview.
My booksellers are all a little freaked out by how obsessed I am with this book. For one thing, everybody was sort of looked at it and went, this is not interesting. And I picked it up. One of our sales reps gave me a copy. And I thought I would poke, you know, Uncle John's bathroom reader. You poke through it. And I said, plumbers, anvils. I mean, I am it's basically funny. It stops 1966. And what it is a combination of pop culture, sociology, and psychology put together to make this exhaustive look at everything from sitcoms, television dramas, radio dramas, comic strips, magazine cartoons, everything that you could possibly imagine that he could look at to see why people thought they were funny and then analyze why they might not be funny anymore. So why are boarding houses, which were hilarious up until the 1950s.
They're not anymore.
We don't have them really. But they were the real world of their day. You put strangers together. You have one cranky person serving them really crappy food. They have to share the bathroom. What more could you want? But one of my favorite things is what is the most demeaning job for a man to do as a husband? And would it be changing diapers, which involves feces, which of course is listed in the book, but no, it's washing dishes. Why washing dishes? Because when you wash dishes, your wife puts a really frilly apron on you and emasculates you. Ironically, if you dry dishes and your wife washes the dishes, that's not funny at all. That's romantic. And that's one of those weird things about the psyche of the time that I will never understand, but he does try to explain it.
That is American Cornball, a laugh-a-pedic guide to the formerly funny by Christopher Miller. Daniel Golden, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Daniel Golden is the proprietor of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. You'll find a list of his picks for this year's best gift books at WUWM.com. That is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air comes your way next. Thank you.